Another point on conflict. There's a lot of talk about gas plays and gas resources. There's a lot of concern about aquifers, particularly in New York and in our territory as well, because that's where the drinking water comes from. That's where the surface water comes from. But the issues that I see generally come from this and this attitude. And this is the first example I wanted to put forward as an issue with resource conflict. There are spaces of dialogue, like royalties and benefits and new technology or ways to protect this or issues associated with it. But there's a lot that isn't. And I thought that was interesting. It's a funny dynamic with unconventional energy that there's both literal and figurative aspects to it that match up, like breaking and fracturation, which is why we've called the film I'm involved in Fractured Land. Because it's not just the land that gets fractured. There's like a picture of me on Facebook where I'm split in half, and that was advisedly done. Anywho, another point on resource-based conflict, at least in our territory, this is Section 4 of the Oil and Gas Activities Act, as of today. And I highlighted a few interesting phrases in that. My issue with the Oil and Gas Commission, for a number of reasons, is just an issue about credibility and an issue with how a single window regulatory agency can do so many difficult things all at once. I'm not saying there's bad people there, I'm not saying they're evil, but I am saying that it's very difficult from my perspective, after the things I've seen, to really fully trust that an entity that has both the mandate of the provincial government and the mandate to protect the environment and the mandate to expand oil and gas production and the mandate to comply and enforce and the mandate to provide a good return for British Columbians, how does that balance out? And again, this is an aspect of resource conflict that I don't think is well understood, but I think it's significant. Another point, and this is sort of scientific uncertainty, and again, I'm going to try and run through this as quick as I can. This is a map created by Gilles Wending, a hydrologist who works for Fort Nelson First Nation. So what I'm going to show you is actually this on a 3D scale. There we go. So these are just, this is a field, typically, about now. Active, completed, cased wells, suspended, abandoned wells. So this is what our territory looks like now. Between 28 and 31,000 wells in Northeast British Columbia, depending on the OGC, the NEB, they have varying figures. A lot of wells. So our territory in Northeast BC, much like Alberta, has a lot of existing infrastructure, both surface and subsurface. The issue is what's going to happen as unconventional energy develops. So this is sort of our modeling of what it might look like. And these lines, they're actually meant to be sort of at the bottom going out like that Chesapeake oil slide. It doesn't show up well on the slide. But the idea is that over time, say 10 or 15 years, 20 years as the field is developed, you're going to have more and more drills and more horizontal, you know, shots and more fracking in your target seam. You know, and that is what it is. But the question about don't worry, it's all going to be okay, becomes a real problem when you look very closely. So I'm going to take a little snapshot of this section right here. So this is the shallow aquifers I mentioned earlier. This is your target zone. This is what's in between. I mean, we've had wells up there since the 60s. And I guarantee you the drilling technology is not the same as it is now. So the question is, how does this all interrelate? What happens when there's localized seismicity? What happens when you have thousands of pounds of pressure and abrasive proppants going downhole? What happens if there's a failure? What happens when there's unanticipated things in the aquifers? There's different kinds of breakages. Who knows? And so we've been arguing with the provincial government about possibilities. For example, medium and long-term water contamination. So the claim is, of course, that these are, you know, this is a deep aquifer, probably not drinkable. This is a confining layer. So the theory is that there's sort of absolutely non-permeable layers in the rock that ensure there'll never ever be any migration of contaminants uphole. But because you are going subsurface with 20,000 pounds per square inch, and because there is local seismic events up to, I think, the average 2-3 on the Richter scale, so relatively small, it'd be tough to feel them. But what do those do to the wells that were drilled back in the day? What do they do to other wells? What happens when you haven't mapped the aquifers underground? What is the process? And again, because unlike the regulatory agency, my people are compelled to think in long time scales, we consider what might happen in 100 years, because we'd like to be here still, or 200, or 300, or 400. And an aquifer recharge rate, you know, that's a big number, in the eons. And so the question becomes, when we think about resource conflict, what do we do about unanticipated or low probability events that carry high risk for the people who live on the land? Is that an externality, to use economics phrasing? for the oil and gas developers? Is that an environmental externality that doesn't matter when we consider royalty regimes? And that's the nature of these discussions. I mean, to our mind, this is a very significant issue. But, you know, I'm not an oil field engineer. I'm not a hydrologist. I'm barely a lawyer. So I'm not even close to a lawyer yet. I still have to do articles. But this kind of stuff, we posited two hypotheses. One, you have a frack and it goes back up an existing well bore that's not cased properly or creeps up the outside through the capillary effect. It's just a possibility. Another possibility is it does something like that, but then creeps sideways laterally across an unmapped fissure in a supposedly non-permeable layer. I don't want to get into this technical stuff too much. The point is that when we think about resource conflict, we don't just think about fights over how much there is or what's happening on the surface or how much you're impacting us. We're actually arguing about unknowns and very significant unknowns. You know, this is truly new technology. We're truly in a brave new world. But the brave new world isn't entirely equitable. It never has been, especially for people on the edges, especially for the indigenous, especially for the marginalized. And so I wanted to point that out using the example as medium and long-term water contamination. It'll be appropriate for the stuff I want to talk about later. Now, another issue, cumulative impacts. I'll run through this really quick. This, my dad's from up here. I was up there on Monday, and I'll talk about some hard stuff that happened there on Monday. My mom's from right here. My grandma is from right there. This is Williston Reservoir, WAC Bennett Dam, which provides a lot of power in these lights. It's right there. So this is our territory. Come on, there we go. These are petroleum development roads. Oh, there we go. Come on. There we go. These are facilities. So glycol dehydrators, compressor stations, all kinds of stuff. Oh, there we go. Well sites as of 2005, seismic lines and the combination. Now, this isn't to scale. I will show you some maps to scale. But when you look at my territory and the place that my people come from, especially up in the far end, but my mom's territory as well, the notion that just this isn't even considered together. When a seismic line, well, let's say, put it differently, when a lease that will inevitably have seismic, and if something is found, we'll inevitably have exploration drilling. And if something is productive, like in Liard Basin, the world's most productive exploration well ever drilled was drilled there last year. And that's up in this section here. So this is the next big play. They're moving over into the Liard, up into the Yukon side. So it's like that. How can you assess that and say to me, well, we're just selling the rights. We don't owe you an obligation to consult because there's no real impact coming from this. There's no like right to put a shovel in the soil. You're not going to be impacted by that. We'll consult when it comes time to have seismic. And then when the seismic comes, they say, well, it's just seismic. You know, that, I mean, there's an impact, of course, but it's not like this is a facility. And then when the facility comes, they say, well, you know, it's a facility and we're tying in some wells, but, you know, this area's already impacted. There's been forestry, there's been seismic. You know, your relative interest is somewhat low. And then so it goes. And this is the dialogue and this is discussion. And so I hope you can appreciate the nature of these conflicts, because it's very difficult from my perspective to engage and reflect and understand these processes and study the justice system. I was joking earlier that the facade of legitimacy wears thin after a while. Another way to look at cumulative impacts is just the exponential rate of drilling throughout history. And we're not even at the boom right yet. 18,000 wells in BC, that's laughable. We're way above that at this point. But again, notice how it moves. Notice how it starts. That's a conflict in and of itself, because my grandparents were concerned about this. My mom and dad were concerned about this. And now I'm concerned about like that. You know, and then that colors our interaction and our experience. When we talk about solutions to these issues, I think we have to talk about the long term, the long history that led to these situations, not just the current contemporary situation. I mean, we're talking like generations of conflict.